Well, thank you so much for the invitation. The title of my talk today is Choreographing Quantum Spin Dynamics with Light, and it's a talk about some work we're doing in my group at Stanford involving experiments with laser-cooled atoms. And I thought I would start by just giving a little bit of an introduction to why it is that we love these cold atoms as model systems for studying quantum science. And particularly over the past few years, actually, these systems of cold atoms have become remarkably well controlled. It's possible to trap and detect individual atoms. There's sort of control and detection at the same particle level, but at the same time, they're highly scalable systems where every cesium atom is the same as every other cesium atom, and so it is straightforward to have a quantum system with sort of many well-controlled and identical particles. And that has applications in a number of directions. One example, because every cesium atom is the same as every other cesium atom, that's why we define our measure of time, the second, in terms of a transition frequency in the cesium atom. And more broadly, systems of cold atoms enable extraordinarily precise and stable clocks, to the extent where if you had started one of these clocks running when the universe began, it would be off by less than a second today. So that has implications then, for example, for precision measurements of fundamental physics. The high degree of control that I showed in this image on the left here is also something that is likely to be favorable for quantum information processing applications. So there's work towards applying these systems towards quantum computation. And what is somewhat sort of more well developed and well established, short of sort of building a universal quantum computer, is harnessing these platforms of laser cooled atoms as simulators designed to tackle certain classes of problems that are inherently quantum mechanical and therefore intractable to classical computers. So those could be, for example, using the atoms to mimic interacting electrons in a solid state material, but having really sort of simplified models that one can build in the lab and probe their properties and answer many body quantum mechanics questions that can't be calculated. So that direction is known as quantum simulation. And for all of these, they benefit from sort of the level of single particle control I've shown on the left here. But another important ingredient, particularly if one wants to implement quantum gates or simulate quantum materials, is to have control over interactions in these systems. And that's also something where there are a number of different ingredients that are used in experiments. So I've shown a picture of actually atoms that are sort of trapped in an optical lattice, essentially a standing wave of light. And in this particular beautiful experiment, they've formed sort of a checkerboard pattern in the orientations of their spins, coming about really from interactions that are present just when I have two atoms sitting on the same lattice site. There's a direct collisional interaction when atoms are essentially sitting on top of each other. And one can even have sort of longer range interactions when atoms are several microns apart. And those can be achieved not for grounded atoms, right? A grounded atom is sort of an angstrom scale object, but if I want atoms to interact on the micron scale, one can excite the electron to a Rydberg state, a high-lying state that has long-range van der Waals interactions. So here's a similar sort of checkerboard pattern that's appearing now in a longer scale, thanks to the ability to excite these atoms to Rydberg states. So that's kind of a few of the tools that are there for manipulating single atoms, getting them to interact. But one of the actual limitations that will be kind of the focus of my talk today has to do with sort of the connectivity of the interactions that one can engineer in these systems. And in particular, in the examples I gave you and in most systems in nature, interactions are in some sense local. Interactions decay with distance. And that has implications in these pictures for the ways that the sort of ordering of the spins that are formed, but more generally implications also for sort of the flow of information. We can sort of take a classical example to see what I mean here. A nice classical example of the connectivity of interactions is the internet, right? So thanks to the internet, I am able to give you this talk about what we're doing in California. Doesn't matter that you're in Canada. And it really, the fact that sort of we can easily instantaneously communicate across the world has implications for the way that information spreads, right? So sort of you can imagine in the olden days, the sort of common wisdom I shared was with whoever happened to live near me. Physical distance was what mattered. But in the age of the internet, actually my interactions and the information I share tend to be in some highly distributed network of physicists across the globe. That's my community and my neighborhood. And that really changes the way in which collective wisdom develops and collaborations form. So that's a classical analogy, but what are the implications for quantum systems? So quantum mechanics, in a similar way, the connectivity of interactions matters. So just to give a couple of examples, here is sort of a sketch of some system where I have, let's say, quantum bits situated on a lattice with interactions between nearest neighbors. And it turns out that this form of interaction naturally gives rise in principle to a state called a cluster state, which is a resource for universal quantum computation. If I had the same type of interaction, but instead every atom is talking to every other atom, or every quantum bit is connected to every other quantum bit, it turns out this form of interaction naturally gives rise to something called a squeezed state, which is a resource for enhanced precision measurements. And to me, that kind of raises the question, if we could have sort of more flexible control over the graph of interactions, would that open up some new opportunities? And the reason we might expect that is that the structure of interactions governs the form of entanglement of quantum correlations in a quantum system. So I sort of put up this buzzword entanglement, and hopefully it's familiar to many in the audience, but I thought I would take a moment to share my 1.5 minute introduction to what I mean by entanglement to set the stage here. So the simplest quantum system is a quantum bit, which, like a classical bit, can be in the zero state or the one state. The remarkable thing about a quantum bit is that it doesn't need to be in just the zero state or the one state. It can be in what's called a superposition of the two. Fundamentally, it's unknown and unknowable whether the qubit is in the zero state or the one state until a measurement is performed. And when the measurement is performed, it's almost like it has to decide. So I like to use kind of the analogy of a coin, right? A coin is a system with two states, heads and tails. And the superposition is a little bit like a coin that's floating in midair and it hasn't decided whether it's going to land heads or tails. So now the really neat thing, though, is that in a quantum system, you can have a phenomenon that's equivalent to me tossing a coin and you tossing a coin, and we repeat this experiment 100 times. And every time I get heads, you get heads. And every time I get tails, you get tails. But if I look at my tosses alone, the outcome always looks flat random. So there's this randomness, but there are correlations in the randomness. And that tells us that there's some information that I don't have. My coin toss looks random. You don't have it. But when we compare notes, there's actually some information there and not just randomness. So this idea of having information that's encoded in correlations, this is known as entanglement. And this is really the key resource for quantum technologies. Okay. Right, so entanglement, this that information can be neither here nor there, but delocalized, is a crucial resource. But in order to sort of generate that delocalized information, one needs interactions to generate correlations. And so given that the structure of interactions kind of governs the form of entanglement, governs the forms of quantum states that we can make, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had, my dream is to have in the lab something like a function generator for controlling the structure of interactions in my quantum system, in order to realize a variety of quantum states that might be resources for different applications. And so sort of this idea of having this, a function generator might sound a little bit crazy, but at the level of controlling single atoms, the field is really, in some sense, already there. And so I kind of flashed these pictures up earlier, but these are really pictures where each individual spot here is an atom that's trapped at the focus of a laser beam. By controlling the positions of these laser spots, one can really control the positions of atoms in a 1D array, a 2D array, an Eiffel Tower. And I like these pictures because they really highlight the high degree of programmability that can be achieved over the system using laser light. Now, one sort of key aspect here to keep in mind is the length scale. So the wavelength of light is sort of on the micron scale, and that sets the characteristic distance at which these atoms can be imaged and manipulated. So in terms of being able to control interactions, one would like to be able to have interactions on some scale that's long compared to that micron scale. And the topic I'll also be focusing on is to what extent can we have some programmability of these interactions. We'll take inspiration from these pictures I've shown illustrating sort of that light is something that we can very easily control. So can we use our control of light to control interactions in these systems? And actually, I'll mention there are kind of two general approaches we take in my research group. One I touched on earlier is using a laser to excite atoms to Rydberg states that interact on the sort of few micron scale. So that gives interactions that are long range, but still local. But another approach we take that gives sort of even more exotic forms of interactions and highly non-local interactions is to let atoms talk to each other by scattering photons amongst each other in what's called an optical resonator. And that will actually be the focus of my talk today, is this way of using photons to realize more delocalized graphs of interaction. So why would you want to do that? So there are a few different directions that this can go. One is that having many atoms talk to each other kind of in a massively parallel, many atoms talk to each other in a way that's mediated by light, give rise to quantum correlations in a massively parallel fashion. And that can be a way of making resource states, for example, for quantum enhanced sensing. So quantum control is one reason, one direction of motivation. Another direction is that actually non-local interactions, although they sound sort of unusual and unphysical, actually appear in conceptual models from a range of different areas of physics, ranging from condensed matter to quantum gravity. And so by realizing these non-local interactions, we can hope to simulate phenomena from these other fields in our atomic system. And thirdly, there are a wide range of kind of classical computational problems that take the flavor of I'm trying to optimize something that can be mapped to a physical optimization problem, which is minimizing the energy of an interacting system. And that's something where having control over the interactions is necessary to be able to encode a specific problem. So I'll give an example from this sort of area of optimization just to kind of to start with, because this is perhaps one of the types of things you'll most likely read about if you're sort of reading about quantum information in the news or on the internet. You'll find a variety of companies that are working towards applying quantum systems for enhanced, scheduling, logistics, applications like optimizing fleet operations for holiday deliveries. I always kind of saw these things and wondered what do they mean and how do you actually map one of these problems to an actual physical system? And beyond that, there are lots of interesting scientific questions about to what extent quantum systems can give a speed up for these classes of problems and what role entanglement might play. But let me give really a concrete example, because I always like to sort of be able to visualize what do we mean by mapping the problem system. Here's a real world problem that I encounter in my everyday life. It's called the number partitioning problem. And it's basically I have a group of objects with some specified weights. And I'd like to know whether there is a way of partitioning these objects into two groups that would balance a scale. And so for certain conditions on the weights, this is actually a hard computational problem. There's no efficient classical solution. If you're a physicist trying to think, can I build a system to solve this problem? Our natural go-to approach is to map this to a system of interacting spins. How is this related to spins? Well, I could think of an object that's in the left bag here as being a spin pointing to the left, an object that's in the right bag as being a spin pointing to the right. I'll call those two directions plus z and minus z. And what I would like to do is minimize the imbalance between my two grocery bags. So I'll define some quantity that's a weighted sum of the individual spins and say I would like that to be small. Or I could say I want to minimize the square of this quantity. And if I do that, I'll see that this looks like this fz squared is some kind of a sum of products of the spins of the individual atoms. So in particular, there will be some weights that tell me how strongly I want a given spare pair of spins to anti-align. But there will be couplings here between every pair of spins, right? This is some kind of an all-to-all interaction. Every atom needs to talk to every other if I'm going to sort of build this system in the lab and maybe ask, can I use my quantum system to help solve it? And you would like some programmability of the strengths of those interactions, right? So the sort of ingredients you need are some spins, some non-local interactions, and a way to program them. So let me give a flavor of how we can use actually light to engineer non-local interactions between spins encoded in atoms. So basically, I'll think of each atom as a two-level system, with these levels called spin up and spin down, or equivalently, I can think of those as no excitation or one excitation in the atom. And the basic idea is that by using light, we can use light to actually effectively transport a spin excitation from one atom to another. So I would like some process where I can have a spin up atom that flips its spin, transitions to the down state by emitting a photon, and that photon gets converted into a spin excitation in another atom. And if I can do that, that gives me some form of interaction between these two atoms that can be as long ranged as the light can travel. Now, one catch is that what we would like is that with high probability, if this first atom emits a photon, by flipping its spin, that photon is in fact absorbed by another atom and doesn't fly off in some random direction. And that's why we actually put two mirrors around our system to form what's known as an optical resonator. And this yields a situation where if one atom does emit a photon, there's sort of constructive interference of the amplitude for that photon to be emitted between these two mirrors as opposed to flying off in a random direction. And that enhances the probability that two atoms will in fact interact in a way that's mediated by the light. And this general idea of having photon-mediated interactions is really quite generalizes to a wide range of different physical systems. So there are systems of superconducting qubits that interact via microwave photons or quantum dots interacting via microwave photons. In the optical regime, one can have solid state spins coupled to nanophotonic cavities that interact via photons transmitted in these nanostructures. Or the type of system I'll be talking about is one where one really has two macroscopic mirrors forming this resonator and atoms that encode the spins. And which of these systems you choose to work with might depend on your application. So these ones on the left are well established for quantum computing applications. Optical photons are great for quantum networking applications. And these systems of cold atoms are particularly of interest in quantum simulations and also quantum clocks and sensors. And one of the things I'll highlight about the cold atom systems is the scalability of particle number. So there are people working with gates between two atoms in an optical cavity, or large ensembles of 100,000 atoms interacting via photons. At sort of the level of many atoms, one of the key applications that's explored are harnessing these systems for enhanced precision measurements, such as those atomic clocks that I mentioned at the beginning. And so in particular, interactions mediated by photons can give rise to quantum states known as squeeze states that I've kind of illustrated in one example here, where these spins ordinarily have some quantum fluctuations in the direction in which they point. That's sort of illustrated by this Gaussian blob here. If I ask about the total magnetization of my system, there's some Gaussian noise in where it points. But actually by having interactions between these particles that generate quantum correlations, one can actually have a situation where the fluctuations are reduced. And you can think of this as on the left, where there's some uncertainty that's coming from the fact that each atom is a little bit like a coin, right? We had this coin toss analogy before. But the statistical fluctuations of the coin toss can actually be reduced by correlations. And that can be a resource, for example, for enhancing atomic clocks. So that's one direction that these photon-mediated interactions have already been employed. And there are also a number of different directions in terms of using these systems to simulate phenomena inspired, let's say, by condensed matter physics, so realizing super solid phases or topological states of light. I'll ask the question later, can we use these to explore some phenomena inspired by quantum gravity? So those are a few different directions that these systems have been taken and might be going. I want to kind of comment on these sort of two different directions of quantum control engineering specific entangled states and simulation. They're really kind of two sides of the same coin. So on the one hand, there have been demonstrations in these systems of controllably generating, let's say, these squeeze states in which thousands of atoms are demonstrably entangled. One of the kind of interesting things I like to point out is that it's kind of perhaps surprising that I'm even able to draw a simple picture of a quantum state of thousands of atoms, because generically a description of even tens of particles in quantum mechanics shouldn't even fit on a classical computer, let alone in a simple picture. So the fact that we're able to kind of draw these pictures says we're really looking at a very special kind of relatively simple class of many particle entangled state. In the sort of general case, when I have an interacting system of many particles, I can't draw simple pictures. It's complicated to calculate how the system will evolve in time or what the phases of the system will be. And that's sort of the domain of quantum simulation, is to understand these more complex entangled states. One of the things that I find daunting about that field is that one doesn't have simple pictures for guidance. It might seem hopeless to even try to visualize more complex interacting quantum systems. And this is where I was actually fascinated when I learned that there are some ideas about visualizing strong interacting quantum systems coming from the field of quantum gravity. And there's the intriguing concept that in certain cases, I can have a quantum system in D spatial dimension. So in this example, D is one. I have sort of a 1D chain. I've shown it as a ring here. And in order to sort of capture something about the structure of entanglement in this system, one can map this to a classical system with one additional dimension in which there is curved space, space-time curvature emerging from gravity. And the basic concept is that something about the curvature of the space in this extra dimension conveys information about the kind of effective distance between these quantum degrees of freedom that's arising from the correlations between them. So something about entanglement in the quantum system can be encoded in a geometrical picture by invoking this one additional dimension. And this concept is known as holographic reality. Hearing about this, I wondered, holographic because of the extra dimension. Hearing about this, I wondered, is this something that one could, you know, access in experiments? Are there simple model systems where one can explore these ideas? And could they, if so, give us a handle for sort of visualizing and understanding a wider range of many-body quantum systems in the lab? So in order to, you know, even hope to sort of explore this direction in the lab, one would need some starting point of a theoretical prediction for what one should measure in some simple model system. And one theoretical prediction has to do with what you would see if you could build a quantum system that under this duality is equivalent to a black hole. And the prediction is that in such a system, any information that is initially sort of locally encoded in a particular quantum bit should very quickly become scrambled. So this was related to sort of solving the problem of what happens to information that falls into a black hole. Is it lost? In quantum mechanics, information shouldn't be lost. What can happen is that it very quickly becomes delocalized, hidden in these correlations between the quantum degrees of freedom. And the prediction is that if I could build a quantum system that was like a black hole, information should exponentially quickly become scrambled. And if you start to think, could you study this in the lab, it sounds hard, in part because the types of interactions that one needs are rather exotic. And so in models written down on paper, To explain this idea of fast scrambling, there are weird things like particles that can hop in a completely non-local fashion, or behavior that is local but in a very strange geometry. So, for example, models that have been considered involve systems of sort of billiards on tree graphs. Okay, so that also doesn't look like things we normally look at in the lab, but let's ask whether we can capture some aspects of these types of models. So we'll start actually with this idea on the left of particles that hop in a totally non-local fashion. I'm not going to claim to realize, you know, precisely a model that is written down on paper and solvable as solvable as being equivalent to a black hole. But can we capture some aspect of the flavor of these non-local of this non-local hopping? Well, I showed you before that actually there is a way of using light to mediate processes where spin excitations hop, right? Making massive particles hop over long distances isn't so easy, but we can have a process where a spin excitation gets converted into a photon, into a spin excitation in another atom. And that will be a way to generate this kind of non-local hopping in an experiment. Concretely, we like to be able to control these processes with light. And so we have a system where essentially, if I would like to, in this example, convert the spin excitation in the right atom into a spin excitation in the left atom, I will do it as alternate laser field that drives a process where an atom emits a photon from the drive field, absorbs a photon from the drive field, emits into the cavity, flipping its spin. So the spin excitation is converted into a photon. And then in the second leg of this process, that photon in the cavity gets converted back into a photon in the drive field, and the spin excitation has hopped. So that ought to be a way to make these excitations hop in a way that's mediated by light. The experiment where we do it looks something like this. So we have two mirrors that are about 5 centimeters apart. We, you know, turn on a laser field at time t equals zero. So I should add this, the cloud of atoms is sort of, in this example, about half a millimeter long. It's trapped between these two mirrors, and the atoms' positions are pinned in actually a standing wave of light. So the dynamics is purely in the spin excitations. And we can, for example, at time t equals zero, initialize some spin excitations at one region of the cloud, turn on the light that should turn on the interactions, and watch where the spin excitations go. So in this example, they started in this region A, they kind of hopped over to this region B and back. At any given position, you'll see oscillations indicating some quantum coherence in the system. One sort of striking feature is that the excitations don't just sort of propagate outwards from this region A, they suddenly show up in this other place B. And, you know, you might ask, why is it? It certainly highlights the non-local aspect of this hopping process. Why do they suddenly show up here? It turns out this is something we can understand fully by knowing the local intensity of the light field and the local density of the atoms. In this particular example, the center of the cavity is somewhere over here. The intensity of the light field was strongest there, and that's why the spin excitations first hopped there. So all of this we can understand. It's not yet at the level of a function generator where I'm programming my interactions, and we would like to move it in that direction. And so just to kind of give a flavor of, you know, what are some of the knobs we might like for our function generator, one that I mentioned at the outset is the spatial structure. Depending on your application, you know, maybe you would like every atom to talk to every other. Maybe you would want some one-to-all coupling graph, which actually we've been thinking about applications to the optimization problem that I mentioned early on. Or maybe you'd like these exotic tree-like geometries that have been considered in the context of fast scrambling. So I'll get to the spatial structure, but let me mention a few other sort of knobs that we actually have. One is, do I have these interactions where spin excitations hop, this kind of flip-flop process? Or do I have what I would call an Ising interaction, where the Z components of the spins want to align or anti-align? That was what came up earlier on in the optimization problem example. And just sort of nomenclature this flip-flop type interaction of the spin excitations hopping, I can equivalently think of as the spins wanting to align or anti-align in the XY directions. So I'll call that XY. So that's a knob that would be useful to have. And perhaps we'd like to control, are the interactions ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic? Do the spins want to align or anti-align, depending on my application? So I actually want to start by giving kind of a flavor of these last two knobs in the simple case where every atom talks to every other, and then we'll get back to the structure of the interaction graph. Before I do that, let me just pause and ask whether there are questions at this point before I start showing too many other measurements. Okay, I don't immediately see any hands up. Feel free to ask me questions at any time, though, if questions come up as I start showing some plots here. So let's see. So in the simplest case, where every atom talks to each other via the cavity, we naturally actually can write down the form of the interaction in terms of this kind of weighted spin that I introduced at the outset. One of the kind of neat features of our system is that we can actually control just by the orientation of a magnetic field, do we have the Ising type of interaction where the Z components of the spins want to align, or do we have the XY type of an interaction that I can think of as spin excitations hopping? So that's actually one knob that we have in the experiment. And a second thing we can easily do actually just by controlling a laser frequency is control the sign of the interaction. Is it ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic? So just to kind of give a flavor of one thing you can do with this, in fact, if you sort of want to check what is the sign of the interaction, one way to do it is to try to prepare the system in a low energy state and see what that looks like. And so, for example, we start with a simple state, which is all spins aligned along a magnetic field, and then we slowly turn on interactions in a way that should keep the system in a low energy state and ask how it behaves. So actually, this is a non-interacting system as a reference point. And what I'm doing is I'm just varying the tilt of a magnetic field along the vertical axis and looking at the spin polarization as a function of position, and it tracks. The spins point down if the field is down. They point up if the field is up. If you turn on interactions, like let's say these Ising interactions, the Z components want to align, this sort of smooth transition from down to up turns into a sharp knife edge because the spins all want to align with each other, and any small tilt in my bias field will make them point all up or all down. You can kind of summarize that by plotting the magnetic susceptibility of the system. So there's a strong susceptibility at some critical strength of the Ising interaction to tilting this field. They either all want to point up or they all want to point down. Interestingly, if you do the same experiment but have spin exchange interactions, or this XY interaction, the magnetic susceptibility curve, the mirror image I would have for the Ising interacting case. And that might not be obvious. This is sort of saying ferromagnetic Ising interactions are the same as anti-ferromagnetic XY interactions. Why is that? Why does it look like that? In order to sort of get a feeling for that, I can make you a picture of what the energy of the system looks like as a function of this sort of total weighted spin. The Z component, the X component, and yeah, we'll just look at a cross section in that plane. It doesn't look the same for Ising interactions versus XY interactions. So I've chosen here sort of the two cases with opposite signs. The magnetic susceptibility was the same. Why is it the same? It turns out if I restrict myself to a surface of a fixed length of the total spin, then these energy plots actually do look the same. So these two cases are the same if the system is sort of behaving like one big spin. If we would like to actually study the physics of many interacting spins, you might like to get into a regime where actually these two cases are not the same. And it turns out one way to sort of access that regime is if I have any sort of dephasing among the spins that sort of moves me into manifolds of shorter total spin, there's actually then I would expect a significant difference in the way these two systems behave. And in particular, in the case of these XY interactions, there's an energy cost to having the spins dephase. So one thing we can do in the experiment is apply a small magnetic field gradient that should make the system dephase. And what we see is that in the absence of interactions, or actually also with Ising interactions, the spins sort of wind into a spiral texture, showing that they're dephasing as one would expect. But if we turn on these spin exchange interactions, the spins actually stay locked to each other and remain aligned. There's no dephasing. The color on this plot is boring. And that's actually showing that that energy cost to shortening the spin actually protects the coherence of the quantum system. And so one can think of this saying actually, the spin exchange interactions and the Ising interactions are almost the same, except that there's an energy gap between manifolds of different total spin. And this is actually then a tool that can be used to actually protect the system against decoherence effects, either from the environment or even from the light itself. And this is actually interesting because I mentioned these light-induced interactions can be used to generate entanglement. If you want to choose sort of which form to use, the spin exchange form might be more robust in terms of avoiding any decoherence from the light itself. And so this is actually something that could be useful in cavity QED systems, but also this idea can generalize, for example, to short-range interacting systems and making collective entangled states. Okay, so I kind of said this could be useful if you're trying to make an entangled state. I didn't actually say yet how the light could do that. And there are actually a number of different approaches that have been demonstrated, but I want to give a flavor actually for a new approach we're exploring in our lab that takes advantage actually of one feature of the system that I didn't yet tell you about, which is each of our atoms, I sort of describe them as having two spin states. Each of our atoms actually has three spin states, minus one, zero, one. If we want to sort of see one mechanism you might use to generate an entangled state in the system, one thing we can do is initialize the system with all atoms in the zero state. And sort of actually in a classical picture, you might say the system now has no net magnetization that would couple to the light field. But in the quantum system, actually, there's something interesting that happens, which is that what we see is a process where pairs of atoms in the zero state can give rise to pairs of atoms in the plus one and the minus one state. So this is just 100 repetitions of the same experiment where we measure at the end how many atoms are in the zero, the minus one, and the plus one state. And you'll see, on the one hand, you'll see large fluctuations from one repetition to the next, but they always look correlated. So population in the minus one state, there's population in the plus one state. And that's from this mechanism where two zero atoms can, in a way that conserves energy, generate a plus one, minus one pair. This is something that had been studied in Bose-Einstein condensates with direct collisional interactions between the atoms, so that collisions give rise to a plus one, minus one pair. And there it's been used to make states where we have one has a very precise, well-defined number of atoms in plus one and minus one, but no information about sort of which atom is in which state. So that's a highly entangled state that actually can be a resource for enhanced quantum sensing. If you're more of an optics person, this is a little bit like generating correlated photon pairs. We're excited about the fact that we can do this for atoms in a way that is controlled by light, because the optical control should be an ingredient for controlling the spatial structure of the correlations that we can generate. And so in order to sort of cleanly study that, we work with an array of, in our case, small ensembles. There's actually a benefit to having many atoms per site in terms of the strength of interaction that we get in our system. And let's ask how far we can come in controlling in this array the spatial structure of the interactions. So, you know, the dream might be arbitrary control over the couplings between pairs of sites. We'll be slightly more modest and say, can we get arbitrary control over translationally invariant interactions, so the dependence of interactions on distance? Okay, so how might we do that? So we'll explore this again in this scenario where we have this pair creation process of generating plus one, minus one pairs. And the first thing we can do is say, if I want some control over the structure of the interactions, let me first actually turn off the long-range interaction, and then I'm going to controllably bring it back. So the first thing I can do is if I apply a magnetic field gradient across the system, then these plus one, minus one pairs can only form locally, right? If there's some distance between two atoms, magnetic field gradient means that there will be an energy cost to creating this plus one minus one pair. And indeed, if we measure correlations in the population of plus one atoms on site I, the population of minus one atoms in site J, what we'll see is there are correlations here on the diagonal, meaning these pairs form only sort of locally on a given site. But we can now take one extra step and say, let me add another laser frequency. And so now I have essentially two different photon energies that are available. And the difference in photon energies can bridge the energy cost of creating a plus one, minus one pair at a given distance. And the effect of that is that now one sees correlations at this particular distance set by the frequency difference between these two laser fields. And indeed, as you vary the frequency spacing, you can actually see, so this is the vertical axis is varying the frequency spacing between these laser fields. The horizontal axis is correlations versus distance. And you see distance at which correlations are high and the interactions are hence on, that tracks the frequency very precisely. So we can turn on interactions at a distance of 9 sites or 10 sites or 11 sites, depending on our laser frequency. One generalization of this is that, you know, if I have multiple frequencies, I could perhaps have more complex and principle arbitrary interactions versus distance. As one example, it turns out if I add in some higher frequency modulation, and in particular, I'll take my sinusoidal modulation that would generate interactions at one distance, but add some higher frequency pulsing, what I can do is actually add interactions at a distance that connects the two ends of my chain. So physically in the lab, I have an open chain. But in terms of the graph of interactions, I have effectively a ring where the two ends have been connected by this higher modulation frequency. You can see that by the fact that correlations now show up at, you know, in this case, let's say a distance of two sites, but also a distance of the chain length minus two sites, who connected the ends of the chain. It kind of highlights that the interactions can generate a graph with a geometry that's very different from the physical geometry in the lab. And, you know, I can tell you that that's what we did, but we can also just directly from the measured data verify that. So in particular, you know, we think we have a ring, but we can actually just ask the question, if we adopt some ansatz that correlations decay as a function of distance in some effective geometry, where I sort of map the sites to positions, let's say in three dimensions, I can ask what is the best fit geometry to explain these correlations? And what pops out is in fact a ring. And actually in this analysis, my students really plotted a bond between any pair of sites, but the strength of the bond is dictated by the correlation matrix. And so some of them are almost transparent and you don't see them. What you see is the ring. Okay, so that kind of verifies in a black box way that we've created this ring-like interaction graph. We can maybe take a few more examples of what you can do with this. If I actually just take the simple case of, let's say, interactions at a distance of three sites, and do this same reconstruction procedure. So you can think for a moment what might pop out of that. Okay, so what happens if I reconstruct this? What I see are basically three decoupled chains. And that actually makes some sense. I could have redrawn this graph with interactions at a distance of three sites as sort of three rows here of independent chains. So that kind of makes sense. But now you can also say if I have interactions at two different distances, maybe I can kind of, you know, connect these decoupled systems and make, for example, some higher dimensional object. So here we said, let's have nearest neighbor interactions, but also interactions at a distance of nine sites in a chain of 18. We can control the signs of these interactions independently. So just for fun, we'll have ferromagnetic interactions along one direction and anti-ferromagnetic along the other. We generate some correlation, construct geometry, and what comes out of this is actually a Mobius strip. So I think this kind of nicely illustrates that one can realize somewhat exotic geometries that aren't so natural necessarily to build in the lab just by programming the graph of the interactions. And what you can sort of, in this particular case with the signs we've chosen, you can think of this as these nearest neighbor spins are almost aligned, but across the strip, they're anti-aligned. And so there's some kind of spin texture that's winding around the strip. And we can play with, you know, different modulation waveforms and see sort of different geometries pop out when we reconstruct what we've done. So it could be a cylinder, it could be an anti-ferromagnetic ladder. And this kind of gives a number of different directions that we can go, right? So we can certainly explore some exotic geometries, non-trivial topologies in the sense of having a twist or no twist. The fact that interactions can be made to change sign as a function of distance is in the context of condensed matter physics, potentially interesting for studying models of spin glasses. So there are a number of different directions we would love to go with this. Some of them sort of can be explored in other platforms. So something like a ladder geometry you could make also in some array of atoms with local interactions. But we would love to also do things that sort of you can't do in any other platform. And this brings me back to these sort of toy models of quantum gravity that I touched on earlier. So I actually, honestly, myself am definitely not an expert in gravity, but I was very fortunate to collaborate with Steve Gubser at Princeton, who was really trying to understand what is the mathematics that might underlie the reality that we experience as smooth space-time, but which we have reason to believe is fundamentally discrete because of quantum mechanics and the existence of a Planck length. So Steve actually was exploring a model invented a model for this holographic duality in which the quantum system can be thought of as sort of leaves on a tree graph. And that tree graph can be thought of as some discretized version of a curved space with gravity. So roughly speaking, you know, if I have a system of n sites and they're the leaves on a tree, the depth of the tree is only log of n. And if I kind of, you know, wrap that around and show it with periodic boundary conditions, I have some sort of a disk where the radius is only logarithmic in the circumference, so that must be curved, right? Okay, so that's a model on which one can formulate a version of this holographic duality. Perhaps if you can study quantum mechanics on this tree graph, that could give some notion of quantum gravity. So can we do that? Well, the concept that we came up with Steve is if you had some model of where you have control over the couplings versus distance, as we now do, and you had interactions at distances that are powers of two. If the interactions shrink with distance, then it's still not too different from a linear spin chain. But if interactions grow with distance, then actually this coupling pattern should give rise to something that is an approximation of this kind of a tree graph. And in particular, the correct notion of distance between the sites should be measured along a tree graph. These are two totally different geometries, and in fact, sort of at some point in between where interactions are flat with distance, there's kind of no natural geometric picture. Everything is strongly coupled to everything, and we have some reason to believe that the system here might be a fast scrambler. So we were curious, can we build this tree-like interaction graph? You know, the model is simple. We turn on interactions at distances that are powers of two. They grow with distance. We can measure, we can do that in our system. We can program that in. We can measure the resulting spin correlations. And if you look as a function of kind of distance in our physical array, there's some kind of non-monotonic behavior of correlations versus distance. They seem strong at distances that are powers of two. If you want to ask, have we realized this tree-like geometry? There's actually sort of a better way to plot these data, which is to say, let me plot them versus position of the sites on the tree. And those positions, so actually the tree is constructed by taking sort of the site number in the array and going either left or right, depending on first the least significant bit and then the next least significant bit and so forth. So the odd sites are on the left, the even sites are on the right. And so there's a mapping between position in the physical array and position on the tree. It's called the monomap. And if we rearrange our correlation plot according to that map, then we actually see sort of a hierarchical structure of correlations. You see sort of some blocks appearing that matches the hierarchical structure of the tree. And if you plot correlations versus the notion of distance on the tree, they exhibit a smooth decay. So that starts to sort of corroborate that we can in fact realize this tree-like geometry in the lab. And you can take this one step further and ask, could we do a similar sort of black box reconstruction to what we did before for, let's say, the Mobius strip? There's a difference, actually, though, between the tree and the Mobius strip, which is that in the Mobius strip, the vertices on that graph were really like physical sites. But in the tree, actually, only the leaves are meant to be physical sites. And so if we want to try to reconstruct that, we have to take a slightly different approach. So first, we can adopt the same principle we did before from the measured correlations, ask what is the best fit embedding of the sites into, let's say, two dimensions. And we get something like this for the case where of what we think is a tree, where interactions grow with distance. On the left, for reference, I've shown the one where interactions shrink with distance that should be more like a 1D spin chain. My students said, well, why don't we try some kind of a coarse-graining procedure where we draw bonds between sort of the sites that are most strongly correlated? And we iterate that procedure until everything is connected. And if you do that for this system where interactions are growing with distance at powers of two, one in fact sees precisely this tree emerging from those bonds. Whereas in the case where interactions shrink with distance, there's sort of no interesting geometry appearing here in the bulk. So we indeed can then really directly from the measured data reconstruct this tree graph that's an example really of this kind of a bulk geometry that's encoding something about the structure of correlations in the physical system. And as kind of one last step, we asked the question if we really kind of smoothly vary this exponent that says, are we in the chain-like regime or the tree-like regime? You can kind of ask how strongly, what happens if you try to sort of cut the system into two halves? How strong are the correlations between the two halves? And we can try different ways of cutting the system according to the physical geometry, cutting according to the tree, or asking just what is the cut that minimizes correlations between the two halves of the system. And for sort of one of the forms of interaction, if the interactions grow with distance, the tree cut is the one that will minimize the correlations between the two halves, as you would expect. If the interactions shrink with distance, you should cut according to the physical geometry. But actually, if you just look at what is the best way of cutting the system, there's sort of a peak in the correlation strength when interactions are flat versus distance that shows that there's really no way of cutting the system that makes the correlations weak between the two halves. And that kind of corroborates this idea that there's some transition between two completely different geometries, and in between, everything is strongly connected to everything. And that might be a good starting point for seeing the scrambling here. Okay, so with that, I've shown you sort of our function generator for programming interactions between these atomic spins. We have a variety of knobs on the sign of the interaction, the form of the couplings, and particularly here the spatial structure, where we've been able to realize rather exotic interaction graphs in a flexible way just by controlling the waveform of the laser field. So we're really excited about exploring a number of different directions with this. I touched on opportunities for toy models of quantum gravity, but this can also go in the direction of studying topological physics, frustrated magnetism, asking whether one can use the system for optimization problems that can be mapped onto these non-local interactions. There's an open question as to whether one can get a quantum advantage in the particular scheme I've shown you, where we this creation process and study the dynamics on these interaction graphs. There's one particular, actually, theoretical work we've recently done asking how one could, in some similar cold atom systems, study specifically this partition problem with a known quantum algorithm that gives an advantage. So if anyone's interested in that, here's a reference. And lastly, I'll mention we're also interested in really directly probing entanglement in this system and accessing a regime where one can really control the spatial structure of correlations and perhaps generate resources for sensing particular spatial patterns, richer resources for quantum enhanced metrology than have so far been possible. I will, with that, thank the team who have done these experiments. In particular, Eric Cooper, Avikar Parawal, and Philip Kunkel are the folks currently generating the results I showed from the cavity, building on past work by Emily Davis and Greg Benson, and also acknowledge theory collaborators here and take any questions.
All right, well, thanks. Let's please feel free to unmute to thank Monica for a wonderful talk. Are there any questions? Maybe I could start with one. You talked about programming the spatial structure of the interactions. Is there any way that you can think? I mean, how practical would it be to program the sort of temporal offset of the correlations, or alternatively to create states with some sort of controllably time-varying entanglement pattern or something like that? Do you think that's conceivable in this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I guess, first of all, sort of everything we do is dynamical in some sense. So, and the fact that we're used to control interactions means we can easily vary them in time. Now, in some sense, in order to control the graph, we're really using that time-dependent control, right? We're controlling the frequency spectrum, or equivalently the modulation waveform of a laser. I think one could also think more directly. Sorry, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to say I was wondering if it had to do with maybe if you're using primarily a standing wave fields to control things, that maybe that'll primarily lead to spatial correlations in the interactions, and maybe.
I mean, one thing that's maybe worth pointing out is I typically showed you a picture at some fixed time. But of course, we can also look at the dynamics as a function of time. Actually, I might even have some kind. So for example, we can ask as a function of time, how do these correlations evolve? And those are experiments that we already do, you know, measuring at different times, seeing if we have interactions at a distance of three sites, watching how they spread to longer and longer distances. And in general, sort of controlling the time dependence is easy. So of the interactions, it's just controlling something about the laser field. So at that point, it's probably comes down to what exactly would you want to do, right? But we can definitely observe at different times, and the dynamics is kind of the natural thing for us to look at in this system.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Hi, Monica. Thanks for the great talk. I just had a question regarding the measurement capabilities in your system. Like, is it possible to measure in arbitrary bases, or can one do, you know, single side control on these qubits?
So that's a great question. So first of all, I should just make sure it's clear in these last everything we're doing so far, we're not looking at individual qubits, but we're looking at small ensembles. But in terms of the measurement bases, we actually are using measurements in different bases already. And I kind of, I didn't explicitly say that, but actually I have in this slide I'm showing here, and in many of the correlation plots, we actually measure in the X basis. So I showed some plots where we measure correlations between the number of plus one and minus one atoms. But it turns out we actually get sort of, especially for looking at sort of the early time growth of correlations, higher sensitivity by measuring in the X basis. And so actually many of the reconstructions I showed were based on spin correlations in the X basis. And essentially we can do any rotation we want before our readout. So we can get information in different bases. In terms of local control, so actually, I have to say, I was amazed that the folks in the lab made these experiments work, because this whole system is a magnetic gradient. And it turns out when we say we want to measure in the X basis, what we're really doing is a sequence of rotations on individual sites where we change the frequency of our Raman pulse to be resonant at these different positions in the gradient. So already we really are actually doing individual rotations of each site. So we do have local control, and you could, for example, measure in a different basis on one site than on the other, or initialize the system with one site, you know, perturbed or. So we do have local control.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah.
Any other questions? If not, then maybe we should thank Monica again for a wonderful talk.
Thank you for the invitation.